The Guardian.
The Guardian Football Weekly Podcast.
Travelling among the stars like Heidi Fleiss's phone number, it's Football Weekly. Today, FA Cup. Wales for the Welsh as Pompey romp at Wembley. Harry gets his first silver and trusts the Welsh team to have a leaky keeper. Italy, after a week of black cats and mafia, Ibrahimovic provides the twist in the Scudetto tale. And there's a final day run-up from the other big Euro leagues too. France, did PSG go down? Germany, no idea what Rafa's going to tell us there. And Sid Lowe's on the line from Spain. We look at the week's big rumours, including that bizarre Steve McClaren for the Champions League story. We check out your posts and we preview the Champions League. As two sets of English fans descend on Moscow, let's hope their video screen doesn't break down. That's all in Football Weekly.
This is Guardian Football Weekly.
Well, welcome on board Football Weekly then, flying early on a Monday morning. Destination Moscow for one or two pod members today.
Oh, nice one, Rafael.
Rafael Honigstein, you heard there, just leaping in.
Hello.
Hello, how are you doing, Rafael?
Very well, how are you?
All right. I'm here too, clearly. Paul Doyle.
Hi, James.
Hi, Paul. What's your nickname?
I don't have one.
Okay, and Paolo Bandini.
How are you doing, James?
I'm very well. Do you have a nickname? Sovereign Norman?
Not really, no.
Really?
By the way, nicknames don't count if you give them to yourself.
So clearly.
What do your enemies call you? You call yourself AC Jimbo, but what do...
I have no enemies, Paul Doyle.
They probably call you Richard.
I'm not important enough to have enemies. Anyway, it's an important week of football, and it began with the FA Cup, People's Final, etc, etc, etc. I'm going to hand over here, on the basis that I did fall asleep in the second half, to Rafael Honigstein, who actually was there and saw the whole thing unfold. Rafael, very special day, yes?
Oh, it was very special. To be fair, I think it was really amazing for the fans. I don't think you can be cynical about that. The atmosphere was great. You really felt that the two sets of fans really deserved to be there and they really enjoyed it. And the atmosphere was much better than last year, for example. In that sense, it really was great. And the first half was very open as well. It was actually very entertaining. Second half was terrible, unfortunately.
It wasn't unfortunate. It was quite deliberate. I mean, that's Harry Redknapp's
I think you're right. Yeah,
you
I
mean, get big athletic defenders and just stop the other team from scoring.
I was actually surprised just how negative Portsmouth played through most of the game. Even in the first half, they sat back and they were just saying, OK, we'll hit you once or twice and then we're going to score because we're better in attack than you are. Yeah. But we'll just absorb all the pressure in the meantime.
I agree that it was a shame that they were that negative. I think it was entirely predictable and understandable when you look at the fact that, you know, Portsmouth haven't won anything for 58 years. You know, Redknapp knows that if he does blow this, he's going to get absolutely destroyed by everyone. And he also knows that if he lines his team up like he does every week, just to be defensive and not try and do anything very clever, they're going to win. I think it's understandable, much though it wasn't a joy to watch.
Yeah, 69 years, don't
know. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I apologise for all those Portsmouth fans out there.
His first silverware ever, and into Europe they go. Imagine if they draw Rangers in the UEFA Cup. Or Milan, says producer Canby, just getting a bit of salt
indeed.
And inserting it into the wound.
Yeah. No, I felt that. I think the real problem is obviously for the sort of an international audience who tune in to see the stars, because I don't think for them.
Well, I don't want to be too negative. I think well.
Well,
done
I mean, no. What I was saying is, you know, for them, the fact that Portsmouth and Cardiff haven't won it in a long, long time, and they're both sort of underdogs, doesn't really do much. I think the FA were and are a little bit worried that this People's Final is going to become sort of a regular fixture because the value of the FA Cup will suffer in that respect.
I don't think the big clubs won't bother.
No, I think they will bother, but I think. Very good point was made by the Cardiff manager.
Dave James.
Yeah. He said, you know, other Premier League clubs will look at us and think, you know, what are Cardiff doing there? Why didn't we actually seriously have a goal? Why did we not play our first teams and instead concentrated on surviving or perhaps even finishing mid-table? A lot of teams did, and I think it backfired for them.
What about Harry Redknapp, though? His first bit of silverware.
It's quite amazing. I think he... you know, he's always had the press on his side, but now he's evolved into a genuine sort of superhero of English management. And
why is that, do you think?
Well, because, you know, he's old school, he's English, he's got good quotes, he plays the game very well away from the match. You know, they love his charisma and his sort of and the personality that he's built for himself.
He is a successful English manager as well, and there aren't that many of them around.
That's right, and I think you have to sort of almost applaud him in a sense because he's held out for so long and he's sort of weathered this whole storm of globalisation and all these managers have come in and he's still there, even though to have a foreign owner, which is very unusual because usually the foreign owners bring some sort of foreign ideas, i.e. foreign management structures and so on with them. He's still there and he's, I think for once, really got it right in the transfer market as well. You have to look at that team and say, you know, there was a lot of left field buys, bringing a lot of players back who were clearly past their best, and it somehow worked. And you just wonder, you know, from a sort of from my own perspective, you know, how good a manager he could have been if he'd been more keen to actually manage and less keen to spend a lot of time in the transfer market. I looked up some figures the other day, and at 7 years at West Ham, he bought and sold 134 players. When people say, "Oh, he's a genius in transfer market," yes, he did get the occasional great player amongst those 134. He's already also bought a lot of dust, but I think he's, to be fair to him now, he's done very well at Portsmouth.
Indeed so. Well, there you go. Now, Cardiff, they had a brave performance, especially in the first half, and if it weren't for Peter Enkelman, who knows what might have come of this game.
I mean, what he should have done is what few keepers ever do. He should have just kicked that ball. I mean, people saying, should he have caught it or should he have tried to punch it? I mean, he should have just kicked it. Keepers never kick. They kind of look down at kicking the ball in that sort of situation.
I think that,
and I don't think the keeper should be allowed to catch the ball, actually.
I think generations
ever.
I don't think they should be allowed to catch the ball. It wastes far too much time.
Right.
There's nothing worse than when, you know, a cross comes in, a keeper rises above using the ridiculous advantage he has of being able to use his hands and catches the ball. But I think a keeper has to work on his punching habits so he gets more accuracy.
Keepers go down and try and handle the ball because the margin of error is that much smaller. If you kick at a ball and miss it, basically the body area you're presenting...
If the ball is on the ground...
Yeah.
Only goalkeepers and John Arnarisa tried to stoop for it. You just kick it.
Look, generations. I can't believe this, Paul. After all the trouble you got into last time, you're wading straight in again.
No, but it's true, though.
You know what happened when Enkelman last tried to kick a ball on the throw?
Yeah. Olaf Melberg.
Do you remember that? No, I'm saying, I mean, obviously he made two mistakes.
Yes.
You know, the first one where he dropped it and they got lucky and then he did it again. But I don't think, I see Paul's point. I mean, a lot of times they could clear it, and there are a few keepers who do that. But I think in that respect, where he actually had to die for it, I don't think you can expect him to sort of karate kung fu kick it.
It was on the ground.
Yeah, so you die
really
it,
on the ground.
And you control it.
It was on the ground, but it was to his left.
They shouldn't be allowed to smother the ball. Which is what he was trying to do, because that just smothers the game.
I'm not sure what sport you're talking about, Paul. This is football. Everyone's allowed to kick the ball, including the goalkeeper. The goalkeeper, because he has very specific duties, is allowed to use his hands in the prosecution thereof.
I understand that. Right. But as he showed at the weekend, it would have been better in that incident too.
All right, well, you become a goalkeeper and you kick, and you'll see if you do better than people who use their hands.
Well, I'm not suggesting I'd be a better professional keeper than
I don't think they do their job better if they only if they can find themselves to the use of two limbs instead of four.
No, he can use his hands, but they can't catch the ball, which stops the game. The game stops when a keeper has it in his arms.
Right. Okay.
I don't pay to watch a keeper holding the ball.
An interesting notion, and I'm sure it'll be debated at length.
Look at the Champions League final now on Wednesday. People are going to spend a fortune to go and watch it. The ball will be in play for about 50 minutes out of 90.
Right.
So you're being swindled out of 40 minutes.
Right.
And that 50 minutes includes when it's in the keeper's arms.
I think
no one's allowed to touch it.
There is one thing that I think is interesting comes out of this. So I'm not going to subscribe to Paul's no handling bandwagon, but I do think it's interesting. Like, I'm sure a few years ago there was this big push to get the referees enforcing that keepers should only hold the ball for 6 seconds.
Right.
That seems to have gone out the window again. And you have this season, I've seen plenty of games when you've had keepers, when they're trying to run the clock down, hold the ball for 20, 30 seconds. And that is infuriating because it just goes on.
Why should they be allowed to hold it for 6 seconds?
Because
it shouldn't be allowed to catch at all. Use
I've
their
never
hands.
Seen a game where they hold it for 30 seconds.
Oh, okay, maybe.
Do you not watch Italy anymore?
These two covered Italy. They've seen it.
Now, I'm going to move on. Brilliant though this notion is. and just say well done then, Cardiff, for getting that far. We're just seeing lovely pictures on a satellite sports news channel of Portsmouth's triumphant open top parade, and open top refers not just to the bus but indeed many of the fans' attire, and there's some spectacular bits of kind of man breast and stuff spilling onto the streets of Pompey. Go on.
Can I just say, and I know really I'm just furthering his publicity here by saying this, but the single worst thing about Portsmouth reaching a cup final is that we have to put up with more of John Portsmouth Football Club Westwood on television.
Well, indeed.
Well, I've actually met him and he's a really nice guy.
There's a very interesting story about a crew.
He's not a nice guy when he's ringing his bell for half an hour in a game and standing up in front of the people behind him.
Well, funnily enough, the interesting story I have about it, I have no idea whether this will survive Canby's Cup, brutal as it can be, involves somebody else ringing his bell because they were due to have an interview with him. And they turned up at the appointed time, rang his doorbell, and nothing was there. And there was no answer. So they were going to make their way when finally he stumbled downstairs looking a bit sheepish. And they said, were you still okay to the interview? And he said, yeah, sorry about that. I was upstairs having a wank.
You've got to love him for that.
Rashford. Now,
speaking of goalkeepers and Portsmouth, do you know who Portsmouth's first ever goalkeeper was?
Yes.
Yes.
Arthur Conan Doyle.
That's even I know
but they
that.
Weren't really? Portsmouth at the time, they were Corinthians.
They evolved into Portsmouth.
Well, that's a good question, Paul Doyle, especially because it's the one thing that I know the answer to. Listen, well, there you go. So have we said, well done, Pompey, and commiserations, Cardiff? We have. Let's move on in this rather shapeless and baggy and yet groundbreaking part one to an interesting story which came up over the weekend, which was Thaksin Shinawatra apparently sending letters to his entire squad saying, you're up for sale, clean out your locker. And then apparently there was whoever the chairman of Man City is sending a letter around to the player saying, I'm really sorry, I blew it by selling this club to Thaksin Shinawatra. And I should add that Thaksin Shinawatra has since threatened to sue anyone who says that he's selling off his entire squad, because that's absolutely not true, says Mr. Shinawatra. But it does seem like things are going from bad to worse very, very rapidly at Man City. Well, I think that probably covers everything as regards part one. So let's just have a little jingle and see if we can't start afresh for part two, which will have Raphael on Germany, Paul on France, and of course Sid on Spain.
You're listening to Guardian Football Weekly.
Part two, then, continental news. And how about this for a doozy? Producer Canby's just been in my ears saying, have we heard the story about Steve McClaren going to Holland to join Twente? Raphael.
Well, Twente qualified for the Champions League the weekend.
Wow, Steve McClaren in the Champions League.
At the expense of Ajax, which is quite a big shock in Holland. And Fred Rutten, of course, the Twente manager, is now going to coach Schalke in Germany next season. So, interesting signing on Twente's behalf. Not quite sure what they see in him.
I tell you what, they see a man who took Borough to the UEFA Cup final.
But by
and he took England to...
Well, nowhere, but that's England.
Yeah.
Honestly, this is Steve McClaren's enduring success existence in the professional football manager's role at all continues to absolutely baffle me. I mean, at Middlesbrough, Steve Gibson gave him huge funds to invest in his squad, which he consistently ploughed into lower mid-table finishes. He won the League Cup and went on this preposterous UEFA Cup run, which involved getting to the last 5 minutes of a game and going, oh God, we're losing, let's put everyone on and see what happens.
It worked for him.
Massimo Macaroni suddenly deciding that actually he might score a couple of goals before going home. And then somehow going from there to England manager, where he did badly. And
if only Macaroni had been English, you know.
Indeed.
A different story.
If only he'd had Massimo Macaroni to throw on. And now he's actually sought after by a club going to the Champions League. How does this happen?
You have to say, though, you know, Twente are a very, despite the fact they're in the Champions League, they're a very, very small club. So he'll be, I wouldn't say starting afresh, but he'll be on a significantly lower wage
than
he was at Middlesbrough, you know. And it just shows that perhaps there wasn't that much demand out in the market.
They're all about youth development at Twente. I know Watford, for example, have looked very closely at what Twente have done there to plan for their imminent rise.
Oh, excellent. Well, that's very well done, guys, for picking up that ball and quite literally running in it in the kind of way that you don't want to see goalkeepers doing. Germany, Raphael.
Yes.
Yes.
Very emotional. If it was the people's final in England, it was the very emotional farewell Saturday to Marcus Merck, the referee, Ottmar Hitzfeld, the Bayern manager, and of course Oliver Kahn.
Right.
The first two cried, Kahn didn't. It was all rather touching, and Kahn even swapped the shirt with the referee afterwards, which looked very funny. And
what size was the referee?
These are very stretchy, shirts.
Right.
And of course, Bayern had won the title. Bremen and Schalke are confirmed in the Champions League. But one more piece of interesting news, perhaps, that Hoffenheim, second division outfit, who are from a small village with about 3,000 inhabitants, have actually made it to the Bundesliga on the back of millions of euros by the main benefactor, who is the head of a big company, a software company in Germany. And he is really, for the first time in Germany, sort of going down the English tycoon stroke oligarch model of, I'm going to take a club, I'm going to put lots of money in, and we'll see how far we go.
It's like Blackburn or, say, Parma in Italy.
Yeah, and he's done it.
Wouldn't it have made more sense to choose a team that had a few fans?
Well, they've been quite smart or quite cynical, depending on your viewpoint, because they've said, okay, this region where we're building this new club actually doesn't have a sort of local club. There's a lot of people living there, and there's a lot of smaller clubs in the vicinity, but there is no one big club that could, you know, get all the support from all these people. So he said, okay, we'll build a huge stadium, will take over this club, and you know, they're sort of ahead of their 5-year plan because they didn't expect to actually go up this season. But they've done it smartly. I mean, they spent a lot of money, and they just signed an 8 million euro Brazilian just before the season started, you know, which is unheard of in the second division for Germany. But they've also sort of looked very closely at what Arsenal are doing in terms of the training ground, in terms of the youth system, in terms of the structured approach between all the different ages within the club. And they've really sort of given a blueprint to the manager, Ralf Rangnick, and say, here, design a club for us, not just be the manager. And it's very, very interesting. And it's an interesting experiment because, you know, traditionally in Germany, people look at money and football in a sort of always slightly dubious sense. You know, you're not expected to buy a success in a sense, but they've done it well, and they've done it intelligently. Mm. And it's going to be one of the most exciting stories next season to see how they fare in the Bundesliga.
Hoffenheim. Paul, Le Championnat, Ligue 1 coming to a close this weekend.
It did.
Who went down? Did PSG go down?
They didn't, no. Oh. They won 2-1 away to Sochaux. And instead, Lens went down.
What, just one team goes down?
No, with Strasbourg and Metz were already down.
All right, okay.
But Lens went down, which just 15 months ago, they were vying with Lyon for top spot on the table. So they've collapsed, and they went down for the first time in, I think it's 19 years. But it's a spectacular failure on their behalf. They started the season with high hopes. They brought veteran Guy Roux in to manage the team. That was a bad decision, as it turned out, because his outdated methods and autocratic personality alienated much of the players. That's where the seeds for their failure were sown. And funnily enough, Bordeaux wanted Roux as well. They didn't get him, so they had to go for Laurent Blanc, who ended up guiding Bordeaux to second in the table in his first ever season.
So
as
Lyon
manager.
Took the title. Then.
Lyon took the title because Bordeaux only drew at Lens. And Lyon had an easy game away to Auxerre, and they went 1-0 up in the first minute. They were 2-0 up a few minutes later, and they won 3-1 in the end. Nancy lost, so Marseille made it into the Champions League, and joining Nancy in the UEFA Cup will be Saint-Étienne, making their first appearance in a European competition in nearly three decades.
Yeah, but just one question on the France squad. I noticed that neither Bakary Sagna nor Gael Clichy have made the group of 30, which seems rather surprising given how well both have played this season.
Yeah, I think Sagna would definitely have been in it had it not been for his recent injury. I'm not sure how close he is to recovery, but not close enough, obviously. And Clichy, I agree, could possibly have been in there, but Evra is very good, and Abidal is a favourite of Dominic and combines particularly well with Malouda down the left. Too much competition.
So he's already announced his 30, has he?
Yeah.
It looks increasingly likely Paolo Bandini that Alessandro Del Piero will be taking part in Italy's European campaign after another two goals on the weekend, which saw him actually finish top scorer. And so he's only the second man ever to finish top scorer in Serie B and then the next season finish top scorer in Serie A.
After Paolo Rossi, indeed. Yeah, I mean, he's actually had a fantastic season. I think it was almost more impressive is when you look at the fact that Juventus have had the top two scorers this season, because Trezeguet was second with 20 goals. The Champions League spots, obviously, we had this weekend coming up as well. Milan got pipped out. They beat Udinese 4-1, but Fiorentina waiting until the 75th minute or so, I think it was.
Right, no, it was later than that. It was only like 83. It was a brilliant. Did you see the goal?
It was a fantastic goal. Overhead kick. Glorious.
By young, what was his name? Pablo Osvaldo. The
Pablo Osvaldo, indeed. Well, Inter, of course, decided to play absolutely horribly for the first hour of their game against Parma, and then Zlatan Ibrahimovic came on, did it all on his own.
It was quite an extraordinary thing, actually, because it was a dismal day at Parma, and the rain was pouring down, and the pitch was pretty much unplayable by the end. But they did look like they were heading to another final day, another one of those big games where they just don't get into gear until the last 10 minutes and go, oh, we better score a goal, and then it's too late. And Ibrahimovic, he hadn't scored a goal since they last played Parma, when the referee gave them a big helping hand and they won. He hadn't played since March the 29th, and he had been rushed back to be on the bench. And frankly, when he came on at half-time, I think most of us thought, well, you know, he hasn't played in 7 weeks, so what's he going to do? But in 17 minutes, he wrapped it up.
It's interesting, because obviously today, and you have to give him some credit. I mean, Mancini, it's his third title in 3 years, if you know, taking into account that awarded to them for Calciopoli. You know, that's now no other Inter manager can say that, not even Elenio Herrera.
But do you take that seriously? I think.
But, well, this is what I was going to say, is that the thing is that, you know, and he's obviously getting credit for bringing on Ibrahimovic when he did. I mean, I just think Mancini is in this position now. He's won 3 titles in a row, and yet still the best thing for Inter would be for him to leave. Because, I mean, Moratti said he wants him to stay at Mancini. Pellegrini has been linked with Chelsea, which I think is absolutely no way that's going to happen. But
why do you want to see him go?
Well, I don't want to see him go necessarily, but I just think if you look at the way the team has performed since he threatened to resign after that Liverpool game, there's been absolutely no stability in the team. It seems very much like a team that lacks for leadership. I mean, obviously last week, Materazzi deciding he was going to take the penalty even when Cruz should have been taking it, and the players supporting him. Now, that says a lot about the fact the manager has no authority there. I don't know. For me, there's a lot of things that you just look at what Mancini's done there, and I think, well, they've got a very strong squad in a league that is, you know, really finding its feet again still after Calciopoli. I mean, it was more competitive this year, but it wasn't that competitive for most of the year. I think they'll be worse again next year if he stays. I think if they want to actually kick on and be more than what they have been, then they need to bring in someone new.
I think it's a very well-argued point. I think two more things that possibly suggest he might be on his way, although Moratti continues to stress that he will, as far as he's concerned, be still on the interbench next season. One is the fact that after the game, when they had finally wrapped up this third title in the pouring rain, etc., etc., neither Mancini nor Mihailovic would speak to the press, which I thought was a little bit unusual when you just won the Italian title on the last day over Roma. The second thing is that one of the reasons they were so grouchy was that they've had a pretty interesting week of phone taps. And we all know about the Italians and phone taps. They have a phenomenal number of phone taps running. Whenever the police have anyone under investigation, they'll just record as many phone calls as possible. They've been recording the phone calls of this bloke called Domenico Brescia, who's suspected of having mafia connections and is currently on trial for being largely a cocaine dealer. And interestingly enough, he has had a lot of phone calls to and from with various people in the Inter organisation, including Roberto Mancini and various players and one or two directors as well. And Mancini has also discussed matters with a friend of this fellow Brescia, who was a mafia bloke on the run in France. Mancini's recorded having a chat with him saying, "When are you coming back?" And the other guy says, "Oh, I don't know. I think I'll wait and see if my appeal goes through." Mancini says, "Okay." Mancini later tells Brescia, "Oh, I told him to stay put in France to wait for a pardon." And there's also a very interesting phone call where Mancini, all the players and etc., use this bloke Brescia, who's now on trial, etc., for getting discounts on luxury cars, clothes, etc., because by profession he is a tailor. However, there's a very interesting set of phone calls where one interperson says, "Oh, how many packages have you got in the back of your car? I need a couple," to Brescia. And Mancini as well says, calls Brescia up and says he urgently needs two stampelli. Now, my Italian's not what it was, but a stampelli either means coat hangers or crutches, the things you use when you've got a broken leg. I cannot imagine why Roberto Mancini, Inter manager, would be ringing up this fellow Brescia with all his areas of expertise, inverted commas, and saying, "Ah, I need a couple of your coat hangers urgently." So anyway, that's been an interesting little
sign. I've often found myself in that situation.
Hotel if only rooms, you had a man to go to.
He's a tailor. I mean, you know, where else would you go for your coat hangers?
Well, that is true. That is very, very true, Paolo. So nothing strange about that. Ibrahimovic, I liked his comment afterwards when they asked him for a quote. He says, "I play, you talk."
That was like when journalists, when Kenny Dalglish was manager of Liverpool, and journalists were doorstepping up, they chased him and said, Kenny, a quick word, just one quick word. And Kenny looked at him and said, "Velocity."
Cracking stuff. Catania in the end stayed up. Empoli went down, and the team that Inter beat, Parma go down. 18 years of Serie A, and much of it very, very glorious indeed. We had Giallo Blu, not surprisingly, posting in and saying, "What's your view on the relegation of my team, Parma?" Mentioning some of the players who've been there over the years: Brolin, Asprilia, Zola, Buffon, Cannavaro, Turam, Adriano, Frey, Mutu, Crespo, Veron, Chiesa, just some of the great names that have played for Parma.
Yeah,
and there
they
go.
What about Brolin?
Thomas Brolin, another great one.
Great name.
What a great name. And no, he was a good player. A little bit on the chubby side. But great player. And it's a real shame to see them go, Paolo.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my suspicion is they won't be down long.
But the other question still to be decided on the final weekend was the top four place. And as Paolo's mentioned, Fiorentina stuck it with that Osvaldo goal away to Torino. And credit to Torino, because they made a real game of it as well. Mm. They had a good goal disallowed for offside, slightly marginal there, Torino. Mm. And Milan, despite the fact that they finally found form at home, which has been their problem all season, a 4-1 win at home to Udinese, have to content themselves with the UEFA Cup, the first time that they've missed out on the Champions League or the Champions League preliminary since 1995. And now, your question about Milan, Rafael.
Yeah, the question is for me, what's happening now? Because it seems to me as if Berlusconi has found his wallet again. At least they've made some move. Now, will this fifth place encourage him to spend even more? Or he's going to say, let's wait till we get the Champions League millions back in next season.
It is interesting. Like the fans are demanding purchase. There's also signs saying, now we've shown faith. Now we expect some repayment in the transfer market. Gagliani mentioned 7 or 8 new faces yesterday. So they will definitely be bringing in players.
And they'll have to play big wages, bigger than had they been in the Champions League, because they're less attractive now by dint of being in the UEFA
Cup. But that does seem to be maybe their policy. Kakar, for example, we were talking about last week, was the fact that he's, by some figures, either the or one of the best paid players in Europe.
But you saw what Bayern had to do this year because they weren't in the Champions League. They had to pay crazy money to
players
to come.
I mean, to be fair, I think if you want to get Luca Toni Ruri, you would have paid crazy money full stop, regardless of where you're playing. That's the real reason they go, even though, you know, they all said, oh, Champions League. In the end, Artemi Nuno said, okay, I'll play in UEFA Cup. It's not such a big problem for me. Mm. I don't think that any Milan targets will say, oh, yeah, okay, in UEFA Cup, I'm not coming, if the money's right.
But the
real question for me is, you know, will Milan finally spend it? Because as you said, Paula, they haven't really, they've been suffering from underinvestment from quite a while now, and they've relied on all these guys to prolong their careers endlessly. But it seems as if they've hit the wall now.
Well, indeed, Cafu playing his last game yesterday, Serginho playing his last game yesterday, Gattuso probably joining Bayern, and that's where Flamini comes in. There you go. Now, still to come on Football Weekly, we have Sid Lowe in Spain and our special look forward to the big event on Wednesday in Moscow, the Champions League final. Part 3 begins in fine fashion with Sid Lowe.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, Sid. And whereabouts in Spain are you?
I'm in Madrid today.
Great news, great news. I saw them lifting an extremely large trophy yesterday.
You did see them? Yeah, it was. I was about to repeat you then, wasn't I? Oh, I just managed to stop in time. Anyway, what were you saying?
Big trophy, Sid. Go with it.
Big trophy, James, yes. Yeah, it was their celebration for the league title yesterday, and they were absolutely surreal. I mean, it was massively, massively over the top, as is always the way with Real Madrid. There were some completely bizarre moments. It was like watching Olympic opening ceremony, or even closing ceremony, I suppose, only kind of without all the sort of universalism of the Olympics. It was very, very strange indeed. There was a moment where these three women came onto the pitch on what were supposed to be kind of chariots, but rather than being drawn by horses, they were drawn by big blokes who were acting like the Hulk, beating their chests and kind of dragging these things onto the pitch. It was so bizarre. And then they put this enormous sheet on the pitch. You thought, what on earth is that about? And that bit was actually quite impressive. They lifted it up to create a triangular thing and then projected images of Real Madrid onto it. All the time, of course, the players are stood at the side of the pitch kind of twiddling their thumbs, looking bored and wondering when they would actually get the chance to jump around a bit and shout Campeones. And the big obsession with Spain in these celebrations is always when Raul will do his bullfighting pass with the Real Madrid cape. And it's something that's always completely bemused me, because I've never understood why everyone thinks this is so great, Raul doing this rather poor bullfighting pass with the cape. But the celebrations went on so long that by the time Raul did this, he was stood on his own in the middle of the pitch. All the other players had gone. Most of the fans had gone as well. While it was very impressive, it was also very, very bizarre indeed.
So final day verdict, Sid, who went down?
Well, who went down in the end was Zaragoza. They were the side that went into the final day, theoretically, in the biggest trouble, but there was a bit of me, I must admit, that thought they would get away with it. Zaragoza went down because they were beaten by Mallorca, which looked like it was going to send Mallorca into Europe, but a late goal for Racing over in Santander sent them in instead. And Zaragoza, I mean, it really is, to be honest, an absolute disgrace that they've gone down with the players they've got. And their board of directors has got things horribly wrong all year. The owner's got things horribly wrong. The president's got things horribly wrong. And the fans last night followed the team coach to the hotel along the motorway, chucking stones at it.
My word, what a terrible end to the season for them. So Champions League picture, Villarreal and Real Madrid, obviously, as champions. Barcelona and
Atletico Madrid, who were beaten yesterday by Valencia, but it didn't really matter because Barcelona had won on Saturday night away at Murcia, which was a bizarre game as well, 5-3 to Barcelona. And that meant that yesterday Atletico Madrid couldn't take third place, even if they'd beaten Valencia, which they didn't do. They were beaten 3-1, but there was another brilliant goal from Sergio Aguero, who I think has been the best player in Spain this year.
Magnificent. Listen, a couple of posts then, Sid. Mateo83 wants to know why Bojan doesn't want to play, or Boyan rather, doesn't want to play in the Euros. What's wrong with him? It seems suspicious. A diarrhea first and now this.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of theories about this one. What Bojan himself said was that he was absolutely shattered and that he really couldn't play anymore. And I've got some sympathy for that point of view, in so much as he's 17, he's played consistently for the last 2 years, because last year he had the under-17 World Cup. The year before that, he was playing for Spain's under-16s, I think. So he hasn't really had a summer yet. He's gone into the Barcelona team, into the first team, with all that entails. He's played brilliantly, and he says he's shattered. Now, the problem is, of course, that if at the age of 17 you're given the chance to go to Spain's squad to the European Championships and you pull out of it, then, first of all, you might irritate quite a lot of people. And Bojan, quite interestingly, was booed by the Murcia fans on Saturday night, because they consider it to be, you know, how can you pull out of the Spain team? And not only that, but it makes you wonder, doesn't it, if in the long term, if he's maybe not going to be psychologically strong enough to make it as a really, really big player.
Tracy Austin, do you think, that kind of thing?
Tracy Austin.
Yeah.
Brilliant. The analogy in Spain is Jesús Navas, of course, who's been in the Seville first team now for 5 years. And for 5 years, we've all been saying, he's going to be great, this kid. And he doesn't want to play for Spain because he has anxiety attacks every time he leaves home, pretty much. And so doesn't want to play for Spain. And it just does make you think, maybe he's never going to make it.
Well, it could be an indication of the declining importance of international competition among this generation of players. Are Europeans getting like some of the top South Americans who often opt out of the Copa America?
Well, that would tally with a couple of things. And the first one it would tally with really is the thing that Joaquin said not so very long ago. Now, Joaquin in the end was devastated not to go to the Spain squad, or so he said. But about 6 months ago, he said the reality is the Spain squad is a complete joke. And of course, this was at a time when Luis Aragonés was at his mad best, and things were being very, very surreal every time the Spain squad met up. And it did seem that some players really couldn't be bothered with it. So yeah, that could be a factor.
Sid, I've heard from somebody who sometimes knows a few things about Arsenal that there might be a swap deal on the table. Adebayor for Yaya Toure and Eto'o. Has that been picked up in the Catalan press, and what's your view on the possibility of that?
Well, the Catalans have been quite keen on the idea of Adebayor. They've pushed that quite hard. They believe that's a genuine possibility. However, I think they would consider that Eto'o and Yaya Toure was a very high price to pay for Adebayor. I think they would think a much fairer swap would be straight on Eto'o for Adebayor. I do see that as a possibility, but I'm not convinced that it will ultimately happen, although certainly Samuel Eto'o is someone that Arsenal have been watching for a long time now. Even before he went to Barcelona, Arsenal had been keeping a tab on him when he was at Mallorca, when of course he was the best striker Mallorca had ever had until this year, when Dani Guiza has overtaken him.
Why now, speaking of Dani Guiza, Timo from Vienna says, did he finish top scorer?
Yes, he did. He scored again yesterday, so he finished the season with 27 goals.
Is he actually any good, and will he be staying at Mallorca, Sid?
No, he won't be staying at Mallorca. Yesterday, very consciously at the end of the game, he was kind of waving to the fans, and there was a tear in his eye, and he's admitted that he's currently going through a series of options and trying to decide which one to take. At the moment, the most likely option looks like him going to Roma. Is he any good? Is one I'm struggling with a little bit, because he has been phenomenal this season. He's very, very quick. He's a very clever finisher. But he has got the vast majority of his goals away from home this year. And I think that's indicative of the fact that when he's able to play on the break, it makes it makes it much, much easier for him. I mean, 19 of his 27 have been away this year. And obviously what that means, if you go and play for a really big club, playing on the break tends not to be quite such an easy option, and therefore maybe it's less likely.
That would suit Roma quite well. They are very much that kind of a team. They don't like to play with... it's very much about breaking and fast balls from midfield to service somebody up front. Nice one. Sid, that's excellent. Possibly if you're around on Thursday, if we could catch up with you then.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Magnificent. In the meantime, have a wonderful week.
I'll try. Cheers.
Thanks, Sid. Quick look at posts. Instant thought on the subject of Rui Costa. Nice salute. HMOCC says, what was that about Rui Costa not scoring goals? And he has figures here to suggest that Rui Costa did. It must have been when I wasn't watching then. Roy A1 doesn't agree with Sean Ingalls' defending is easier than attacking theories. Ade Akimbaye. Oh, he has a long post here and a very, very full and frank disclosure on the whole business of relegation in Mexico, which we've had one or two errors with. If you're down at the bottom of the table in Mexico, it doesn't mean anything. They decide relegation based on your average number of points over 3 seasons. And if you're only up for 2 seasons, you can still go down as long as your average is Badenoch says Akinbayu. I'm a bit confused about that, but it is extraordinary. And for anyone who's still reading this, he adds at the end, in 1999, another Mexican side found a very sneaky way of escaping relegation. With the lowest points average after the 99 Clausura tournament, Puebla was destined for the drop. Puebla's owners then went and did what anyone in their position would do. They bought a team that had just earned promotion, changed the newly promoted team to team's name to, you guessed it, Puebla, and swapped rosters with said club. Thus, Puebla remained in the first division until they were relegated the next year. Anyway, that's karma for you, isn't it? I think that all that remains to be done in this pod today is to salute the Champions League final, which takes place, Paul Doyle, on Wembley. And no, you're not allowed to leave until we discuss this fully. At the Luzhniki Stadium, is it going to be like the FA Cup last summer? Is it going to be like the recent exciting clash at Stamford Bridge between Chelsea and Man United? What's your view?
I think it'll be closer to the second of those two. I'd imagine. Yeah, I imagine Chelsea will go for it. I mean, United will go for it too.
Right.
But I think if both of them go for it, Chelsea will win because they're simply more powerful than United.
Raphael's sucking his teeth and furrowing his brow. I predict a tense affair.
Well, it could be tense, certainly. Mm. I'd be interested to see who's at right back, because obviously in that recent league match, Cristiano Ronaldo didn't play for most of it. Right back is a weakness in Chelsea, their biggest weakness, we all know. They probably put Essien in there, which is a pity because he's a big loss from the middle. That will certainly give United, make it closer than the league match was.
Yeah, I agree with Paul that it'll probably be a lot more open than most people fear it will be. And I think the reason for that is not necessarily that Chelsea are going to go for it. I think the reason is that they can't actually defend very well. I disagree to the effect that I think United actually have a lot more firepower than Chelsea. I think with Chelsea it's very much, can you throttle Drogba? If yes, then you've already won half the battle. But the real interesting point for me is tactically is whether Ferguson will go by his standards for a negative formation with three central midfielders, the way he played at Stamford Bridge and at Barcelona, which to a large extent stifled his own team rather than the opposition, or go with the tried and tested 4-2-3-1, which at times is a 4-2-4 because it's so open in terms of who's going forward at any given time. So I think for me that is the real question. And then if you factor in the whole Scholes thing, that Scholes for romantic reasons will have to play apparently, that will say to him, well, if I'm only playing with another holding midfielder or centre midfielder, who will that be? If it's Scholes and Carrick, will they be overrun by Balak, Lampard, Makalele in the middle? If it's two more midfielders, does that stifle my attack? So I think actually in a strange way, Ferguson goes into this game with more of a headache than Grant, who already knows his 11 players. And apart from the right back, which I think will be Essien, we could pick that team today.
Right, okay.
You know, there's a lot of talk about Grant, obviously, whether he'll stay and whether he's got one game to save his career or whether he's doomed anyway. Now, I think it's interesting because a lot of people, I think even in today's big paper, saying, you know, is he a genius or is he just a lucky man? And we'll see in this final. No, we won't, because, you know, this final will be decided on one goal. It could be a penalty. It could be Drogba, you know, falling at a very opportune time. Hmm. So that doesn't make Grant a genius. And if they lose that game against United, who are the best side in Europe right now, then it doesn't make Grant an idiot. I mean, the real questions have to be posed somewhere else. And the real question, I think, have nothing to do with the result. And that's why I would repeat what I said before the semi-final against Liverpool. I think this is actually one of the few situations in the Champions League where the outcome will have no effect whatsoever on the future of the managers. I think it's already decided that Grant's moving side or upwards or somewhere else. Winning the Champions League will only make it easier for him to say, I've done my job, I've taken them as far as I can, and now I'll be happy to pull the strings behind the scenes again.
No. Now, off we go then. That's Football Weekly on this momentous week. We'll be back. I won't, or at least I might have some part to play in proceedings, I think, on Thursday. Plans are evolving even as we speak. But in the meantime, Raphael Honigstein, thank you so much for coming by today.
Thank you.
Fantastic work. Paul Doyle, superb.
Thanks, James.
Outstanding. Another career best from Paolo Bandini.
Cheers, James.
Producer Camby, you were amazing. And you will continue to be as you try and fit this all into a kind of pod-like shape. And you, the listeners, fantastic. I thought you were especially good today. Well done for that. Back on Thursday and see you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.